4. Reflections on the engagement at Matane Bridge, October 10, 1999. The largest combat engagement of the Interfet campaign in East Timor, and the only direct clash between the Australian Army and the Indonesian Army, occurred on October 10, 1999, outside the village of Matane, a cluster of about 20 palm-roofed houses on the east-west Timor border. The firefight occurred around a small stone bridge over the Mota Biku River and a portion of coastal palm jungle just within East Timor, to the east of the village. In this combat action monograph, I have sought to describe the engagement accurately in detail. Sources include my company war diary, Support Company, 2nd Battalion, Royal Australian Regiment, after-action debriefs of participants recorded at the time, interrogation notes compiled by investigators after the firefight, extensive combat video footage taken by military combat cameramen and civilian news crews, and the report of the UN Committee on Border Demarcation. Using these sources, I have sought to check my personal impressions, wherever possible, against externally verifiable fact. Background. To understand what occurred at Matane, some background is necessary. Interfet was an Australian-led, UN-approved regional intervention mission to stabilize the situation in East Timor during the mass bloodshed, destruction, and population displacement that followed the UN-sponsored referendum of August 30, 1999, in which East Timorese voted for independence from Indonesia. This vote prompted massive retaliation from the Indonesian armed forces and their militia allies, local irregular armed groups operating as partisan auxiliaries to the regular Indonesia military. These militia groups, led and directed by members of the Indonesian military, had intimidated and killed thousands of members of the local population before the referendum, in an attempt to prevent a vote for independence, and then carried out the bulk of their destruction after the referendum failed to deliver the result they had tried to control. Peter Cosgrove, an Australian Major General and later General and Chief of Defence Force, was the force commander. The mission began on September 20, 1999, with the pre-dawn seizure of key points across East Timor by the International Force, and ran as a stabilization operation until mid-2000, when the UN Transitional Authority, under Sergio Vieira de Mello, later tragically killed in Iraq in 2003, took charge of the mission, which continues to this day. Author's Note, 2009. The Interfet operation, a multinational stabilization mission, was replaced by the United Nations Transitional Authority, East Timor, a transitional governance and stabilization operation that continued until the formal establishment of East Timor's independence on May 20, 2002, when it was replaced with the United Nations Mission in Support of East Timor, a reconstruction mission that ran until May 2005. Once Interfet had invaded East Timor and secured the major cities, within the first few weeks of the campaign, the militia operated as guerrillas, some from within East Timor and some from camps on the West Timor side of the border, from where they infiltrated the border area and attacked international troops and installations and Timorese civilians. They continued these activities for several years after the Australian-led stabilization force was replaced by a new UN peacekeeping force, but they never amounted to a serious challenge to the stability of the new nation of Timor Lorosai. In terms of military doctrine, this was not a counterinsurgency mission, even though the enemy operated as guerrillas and applied classic insurgent tactics. Rather, the mission involved elements of insurgency prevention, nipping the proto-insurgency in the bud before it had time to grow, and stability operations. Nonetheless, since in logical terms counterinsurgency is a subset of stability operations, and since the enemy applied guerrilla tactics throughout the operation, the Interfet campaign holds lessons for counterinsurgency tactics, and these lessons are the focus of this chapter. October 10, 1999 was day 21 of the Interfet campaign, or D plus 20 in operational terminology. In the preceding 3 weeks, my company's parent battalion, 2nd Battalion Royal Australian Regiment, 2 RAR, had secured Comoro Airfield and Dili Harbour as the lead combat element of the Interfet Intervention Force, having several minor brushes with local guerrillas and Indonesian regulars in the first few days, then spreading out to secure the East Timor capital, Dili, as the remainder of the force arrived. Author's Note, 2009. Australian infantry battalions number about 700 people and consist of 4 rifle companies, a support company made up of specialist troops such as reconnaissance, heavy weapons, snipers, communications and assault engineers, known as pioneers, and an administration company, including medical, logistics and transportation platoons, and a battalion headquarters. 2nd Battalion Royal Australian Regiment, in which I commanded support company, operating as a rifle company for the initial lodgment in Dili and then reverting to normal tasking, was a high-readiness light infantry battalion that was part of the Townsville-based Rapid Deployment Force, which was maintained at 7 days' notice for intervention operations across Southeast Asia and the Pacific. The Rapid Deployment Force was organized around an airborne brigade and operated similarly to a U.S. parachute infantry, light infantry, or ranger unit, except that it also included armored cavalry, helicopter, and engineer units. One of our rifle companies, about 110 infantry soldiers, secured Baucau Airfield in the east of the country in an independent operation less than 24 hours after the initial lodgment. After a multi-battalion cordon and search in central Dili and an air mobile clearance of Liquisa, a town near the north coast, our battalion was relieved in place by our sister battalion, 3 RAR, handed over responsibility for security of western Dili, and then concentrated in an assembly area back at Comoro Airfield just outside the city. On October 1st, the battalion and its supporting artillery, armor, combat engineers, and logistic units, plus a special air service regiment element, had mounted the largest Australian air mobile operation since the Vietnam War, and the largest ever undertaken using solely Australian Army helicopters. Author's Note, 2009. The Special Air Service Regiment is the Australian equivalent of the British Special Air Service and of Tier 1 national mission units, such as Delta Force or the Naval Special Warfare Development Group in the U.S. Joint Special Operations Command. It was founded in 1956 and has seen extensive combat service in every Australian war since that time. This operation had secured the towns of Balibo and Batugidde in the western border area, establishing an Australian presence astride the militia group's main escape route from East Timor. This was important because at this time the Indonesian military was evacuating its militia auxiliaries to hastily established guerrilla bases in the jungle along the border, from where it hoped subsequently to wage an infiltration campaign to destabilize East Timor. Preventing or disrupting such a campaign was thus important if we were to prevent the emergence of a full-blown insurgency later. This crucial operation had also carried risk. It had dangerously isolated our battalion from the rest of the force. At this point, more than 10,000 Indonesian regulars and an unknown number of militia guerrillas were still operating in East Timor, many of them between our position and the rest of Interfet. The situation was extremely precarious. In a strategic sense, this was probably the most dangerous period of the whole campaign. The boldness of this move by General Cosgrove to seize the border area cannot be overstated. Because we were so heavily outnumbered in the border region, seizing the initiative was critical, so we quickly pushed patrols out on foot into the jungle and the surrounding villages, mostly destroyed, to dominate the area and prevent further militia destruction and killing of the local population. By aggressive and active patrolling, we sought to convince the numerically stronger enemy that we were a larger and less vulnerable force than was actually the case. By October 10th, therefore, the battalion had been operating at an extremely high tempo for 21 days and nights without any rest. Most people were getting 3 to 4 hours sleep each night, and fatigue was becoming a major problem. This was due partly to lack of transportation, virtually all movement was on foot, and helicopters and vehicles were in short supply. Personal loads being carried were also very heavy. On the day of deployment, the average load carried by a soldier in my company, support company, operating as a reinforced rifle company for this operation, was 71 kilograms, 156 pounds. This sounds like an outrageous amount, but was recorded in writing by loadmasters who carefully weighed each soldier's equipment before embarkation from Australia. The lightest load in my company was recorded at 126 pounds. My personal load was 137 pounds, and the heaviest load, that of a member of a sustained fire machine gun detachment carrying a heavy machine gun tripod and ammunition, was a punishing 212 pounds. These loads were somewhat higher than those carried by the rifle companies, due to our heavier weapons and equipment, but only marginally so. These crushing loads were exacerbated on day 5 by the issue of new combat body armor. In our home garrison base of Townsville, in North Queensland, we had rarely been able to train with helmets and body armor. These were in short supply, and as the battalion only had a week's notice for the operation, our sister battalion 1RAR, which had been Online Battalion, Australia's highest readiness rapid deployment unit, maintained on 7 days' notice to deploy worldwide, until a week out, had the lion's share of this equipment. The new armor was much more effective than our older Kevlar flak jackets. It was American issue and included ceramic armor plates over the chest and back, but it was very heavy, and being rigid made carrying a pack extremely uncomfortable, often leading to numbness and loss of circulation in soldiers' backs and arms. A related factor was that we were carrying a full combat load of ammunition for extended periods, something that, again, we had rarely done in training and had been unable to do during the week of pre-deployment workup. Live, correctly, ball ammunition is considerably heavier than blank ammunition, of course, and besides the extra weight to be carried, this was having an effect on our load-bearing equipment, webbing and ammunition pouches, a new design that turned out to be insufficiently robust to carry such loads for extended periods. The terrain, steep, razor-backed ridges, secondary jungle, and climate, high humidity, daytime temperatures around 100 degrees Fahrenheit with little cooling off at night, contributed to high water consumption and increased fatigue still further. Average water consumption in the first 10 days of the operation, according to the battalion's second-in-command, was 18 liters per man per day. During the Dili phase, this meant that rifle companies needed water resupply at least once, sometimes twice, per day. Once the battalion arrived in the border area, water resupply was much more difficult. The withdrawing enemy had destroyed or poisoned all water sources, military water purification equipment was not available, and the main supply route back to Dili was not yet properly established. It ran more than 100 miles on single-lane, badly damaged roads with few intact bridges and enemy forces still at large along the whole route. So we were very much on our own for the moment, and everyone, to a greater or lesser extent, was dehydrated. Food was also a problem. Frontline troops had seen no fresh rations at this stage. My company, which spent much of the operation in small teams in a remote jungle area near the border, was not to have their first fresh meal until day 62 of the operation. Although troops in rear areas such as Dili had started to receive fresh rations, the supply situation was still tenuous, and in the forward areas all rations at this stage were combat rations, canned or dehydrated food carried in individual packs. Combined with the water shortage, the lack of food left energy levels across the battalion quite low. Many of us were living on our personal energy and adrenaline reserves at this point. Due to the tempo of operations, meals were often eaten cold. I managed my first hot combat ration meal of the operation on day 11. The intelligence picture. Several intelligence sources had warned us of guerrilla camps on the border, opposite our battalion's area of operations. there had been night infiltration attempts by Indonesian regulars and militia, at least one of which reached the battalion main headquarters and resulted in shots being fired inside Balibo town itself. There had also been persistent rumors of an imminent large-scale militia counteroffensive designed to deal with our battalion before the rest of Interfet was in a position to support us. These rumors panicked the local population, but had repeatedly proven untrue. A lack of human intelligence experience or familiarity among some commanders had led to a distrust of all local information sources and an inability to distinguish between unfounded rumor and more accurate information. Many commanders also had great difficulty in distinguishing information accuracy from source reliability. However, on October 7th, we began to receive specific, detailed information on heightened militia activities at Matane. Indonesian regulars and key guerrilla leaders had been sighted there, encouraging and training militia groups and apparently preparing a coordinated attack. Our sources told us that the local population and East Timorese refugees in the area had been mistreated and terrorized. This information originated from three independent sources using two distinct intelligence collection methods, one an Interfet asset and the other a local source who had previously proven reliable. The intelligence officer and myself therefore regarded this as relatively firm, albeit time-sensitive information. Importantly, our attitude to this information was colored by our perception that Matane was in East Timor, and therefore inside the battalion's area of operations, as shown by the village's marked position on our issued maps, which indicated that it was well within our side of the border. As officer commanding support company, one of my tasks was to act as the battalion's patrol master, responsible for the coordination of intelligence, surveillance, and reconnaissance assets and patrol operations within the battalion area. The intelligence officer was responsible for assessment and tasking of certain intelligence assets, while I controlled and tasked other intelligence assets and directed the battalion's snipers, reconnaissance and surveillance patrols, and company fighting patrols. In the early morning of October 10th, with the intelligence officer, I briefed the commanding officer on the new information about Matane coming from multiple sources and our assessment that the village was a center of militia activity. He considered the information and decided to send a patrol to Matane to investigate. His intent was to gather independent verification of the intelligence reports, assist the battalion in dominating its area of operations, and disrupt militia plans for the rumored offensive, while protecting and reassuring the local population. He tasked the rifle company closest to Matane, Charlie Company, to conduct the patrol, but directed the intelligence officer and myself to accompany the patrol. As an Indonesian linguist, my task was to conduct any negotiations or mediation as necessary and question any detainees or local sources. I was also to speak with the local population and reinforce key information and psychological operations themes. Later that morning, the Army Public Relations Team located in Balibo sought permission to accompany the patrol. The commanding officer agreed, and the Army camera team, several civilian news teams, and their media support unit escort were approved to accompany the patrol in Land Rover patrol vehicles provided by 2RAR Battalion Headquarters. The force that approached Matane early that afternoon, therefore, was a mixed group from several units who had never worked together before, had very limited time for orders, and no opportunity to rehearse. Critically, the command relationships within the group were not clear-cut and were based on personal goodwill rather than a clear command chain. The patrol group consisted of the following: one platoon and company tactical headquarters from Charlie Company, 2RAR. The officer commanding Charlie Company, O.C. Charlie, was in overall command of the patrol. By agreement with me during the orders process, this had not been specified by the commanding officer, but was worked out by us on the ground. The company tactical headquarters, support company 2RAR. This group included me, my radio operator, the intelligence officer, and a civil military operations team under the command of an artillery forward observation officer. Again, by agreement, during the orders process, I took command of the non-Charlie Company personnel in the patrol, including the linguists, intelligence operators, civil affairs team, and escorts. One platoon from Support Company 2RAR, mounted in armored personnel carriers from B Squadron 3rd 4th Cavalry Regiment as a quick reaction force held on standby at Balibo. As the battalion quick reaction force, this platoon was under battalion control. But as this was one of my own platoons, the Assault Pioneer Platoon, I maintained constant communications with the platoon commander, and he was tracking my movements during the patrol. The civilian news media, escorted by 2RAR regimental police in armed Land Rovers and with personnel from the media support unit. These media groups followed behind the patrol, but moved entirely on the main coast road and remained about 100 yards behind the patrol until the aftermath of the battle. The mapping situation. A final key piece of background concerns the mapping situation. At this point in the operation, we were working with very poor quality maps by Australian standards. The maps we were using were blurry color photocopies produced by our brigade intelligence staff from 1 to 50,000 scale Indonesian maps dating from the early 1990s. Nevertheless, compared to the maps I had become used to during earlier deployments to Indonesia in the 1990s, when I had commanded Australian Army mobile training teams with the Indonesian Army, these maps were very professionally produced. The map for this operation was Indonesia map 2407-122/121, Batu Gide, 1 to 50,000. We had repeatedly found these maps to be out of date and inaccurate. Errors of 50 to 100 meters in the lateral and vertical positioning of key features were common, and villages and settled areas were particularly inaccurately marked. This was partly because Timorese villages comprise mainly palm and thatch huts with wickerwork wooden fences. They decay quickly, are easy to relocate, and at this point in the operation had been burnt to the ground by the enemy in many cases, and were already being overgrown by the jungle. We had repeatedly requested better mapping products, including air photographs, but none had reached us by this stage in the operation. Ironically, after the firefight, a flood of hyper-accurate surveys and air and or satellite photography was produced that would have been very useful on the day. Importantly, the map showed Matane as a small village some 500 meters east of the border with West Timor. In fact, on the ground, there was no village at that location, and the river at that point, shown as a major feature running through the center of the village, was, at that time of year anyway, a dry and hardly noticeable gully amid the long coastal elephant grass that my company's soldiers, we had just returned from a deployment to northern Papua New Guinea a few months before the Timor operation, called by its Papuan name, Kunai. The actual location of Matane was across a large stone bridge, beyond a major flowing river just inside West Timor, a major difference from what was shown on the map, though no more major than that of many features on the map. A final issue was that the maps we were using were right on the edge of a grid convergence zone. In other words, due to distortion in the projection used to convert the curved three-dimensional surface of the Earth to a flat two-dimensional picture, the grid squares were slightly stretched on the edge of the grid zone and hence were not actually square, but slightly rhomboid on the ground. Moreover, the maps were not based on the Universal Transverse Mercator, UTM map projection, the standard grid system used by military and civilian satellite navigation systems, but on an older projection, the Lambert conical projection, and the grid lines did not match UTM grid lines. This was unfortunate, because our satellite navigation sets gave readings only in latitude and longitude, not marked on the photocopied maps, or by UTM grid. Thus, GPS readings could be, and often were, up to 300 meters off, and were very difficult to relate to the map other than by educated guesswork. The patrol. We departed from the half-ruined Portuguese coastal fortress at Batuguidé in the early afternoon, the hottest part of the day. This was Charlie Company's fortified patrol base, so we moved through their forward defenses and an outpost manned by the mortar platoon, part of my company. We moved west along the coast road for about 100 meters and then cut into the coastal jungle on the north or coast side of the road. The temperature, in our body armor with full ammunition load, was extremely hot in this jungle, which was secondary growth with little shade and extremely still, humid air. The air had a faintly rotten odor. Bodies of refugees and other local people killed by the enemy were frequently washing up on the beach at this time and for several weeks afterward, and a large amount of dead livestock, plus the occasional human corpse, lay in the jungle and the burnt-out villages. The alternating bright sunlight and shade, combined with the limited field of vision, a few feet at most, was quite disorienting. We were also pushing into an area of known militia presence and were expecting contact with the enemy at any moment. I was counting paces for what is known as dead reckoning, a technique for jungle navigation that is used when no landmarks are visible, but I was soon unsure of my precise location because the ground was flat and evenly vegetated with no elevation change, creeks or other features for reference, and we were moving in a meandering single file in the thick jungle. After 300 meters, we emerged from the Kunai grass, rejoined the coast road, and pushed along it in staggered file, a patrol formation in which half the patrol walks on one edge of the track and half on the opposite edge. I was with my detachment of specialist troops, about 200 meters behind the front of the patrol and well back due to the long-spaced patrol formation. A monsoon drain, a narrow canal about 3 feet deep and full of mud and rotting detritus, ran along the left side of the road, with dense palm jungle immediately beyond it. On the right side of the road was a thin screen of trees, some palms, and then a narrow black beach and the coppery grayness of the ocean, calm and oily at this time of day. The air was heavy and hot, but considerably cooler than it had been in the Kunai. As we moved along the road, the two patrol vehicles carrying the civilian media crews pushed up close to the back of the patrol, and I turned back briefly to consult with the drivers, with sweat running down my face and into my eyes. Each vehicle mounted a 7.62mm Mag 58 general-purpose machine gun, and I wanted to be able to call on this supporting fire in case of problems. I consulted my map. You always have a very clear recollection of the last moments immediately before a firefight, and talking with the vehicle commander, I realized we were considerably further along the road than I had expected. I had been expecting to see a major village, that is, Matane, within a few hundred meters, but we had moved a long way and seen nothing but a couple of burnt-out huts since we had left the jungle. The vehicles had moved directly along the road and thus had a better feel for their location. I asked my radio operator to raise OC Charlie, close to the front of the patrol, using the battalion command net radio, and ask him to stop while we confirmed our location. While the radio operator was doing this, I looked up and realized that the forward elements of the patrol were still moving forward along the road, talking to some locals on the edge of the road and about to disappear out of sight around a sharp bend to the left. I could not halt my portion of the patrol without splitting the formation, which is a bad idea when you're expecting contact with the enemy. In any case, I was not in overall command. We could not raise OC Charlie on the radio, so I began to move quickly through the formation toward the front, taking my radio operator. I quickly overtook the rear of the leading platoon and moved to within about 50 meters of OC Charlie, wanting to stop the patrol and confirm our precise location before continuing. As I moved forward, in my memory it seems as if the entire landscape had fallen silent, as in the moments before a tropical rainstorm. There had been loud cicadas and birdsong in the jungle, but now even those sounds were hushed, and my feet on the rough tarmac road seemed to make no noise at all. at that moment, as I was running down the road toward the head of the column, dripping with sweat in the airless heat, the gunfire began like a thunderstorm bursting. The firefight. I remember what seemed to be a single shot, possibly two, followed by a longer burst of shooting, and then suddenly a huge volume of fire, thousands of rounds in rapid succession, all coming our way. The fire was skimming along the roadway at about waist height and higher, chopping leaves and small branches off the roadside trees and kicking up dust. Bizarrely, my memory is of small fragments of dry palm leaves spinning in the air, and my sense of the enemy fire is that it was bright and hot, though in reality I could not have seen it. The sunlight was so bright that even tracer fire was hard to see. The instant the firing broke out, I ran forward and jumped off the left side of the road into the stone-lined monsoon drain. This was excellent cover, with deep, cement-edged walls and half full of rotting vegetation and black mud. However, because it ran directly toward the enemy, it would have been a death trap if they had managed to get a machine gun firing along it or land a grenade inside it. I perceived all this in the moment of jumping into the drain, but it felt incredibly safe to be off the road. Psychologically, it was rather difficult to keep moving forward, although we all did. My immediate concern was for my radio operator and the rest of my party, ensuring that they had all got off the road safely and out of the fire, which was still pouring along the roadway just above our heads at a fast clip, sounding exactly like the sound you hear when you sit in the butts at a rifle range. Strangely enough, this was a very comforting and familiar sound, evoking lazy, sun-filled afternoons with my platoon on the Army rifle range at Greenbank as a young officer, when you came back from the range pleasantly tired, slightly sunburned, and relaxed. As soon as I had confirmed that my people were all safe, I got my radio operator to try again to raise OC Charlie on the radio. The radio operator had already reported, "Contact, wait out," to battalion headquarters in their underground command post back at Balibo Castle, and received an acknowledgement, so I knew our radio worked, but I could not get OC Charlie to answer his radio. The enemy rifle fire was still very intense, smashing into the trees above the drain and cracking loudly just over our heads. I had seen OC Charlie go off the right side of the road, which was a raised causeway, and bending around to the left at that point, so he had moved directly toward the enemy and out of cover. I thought it quite likely that he and his party had been killed in the first burst of enemy fire, and that I would need to assume command of the whole patrol. I therefore needed to be up front where I could see, instead of 150 meters back. Ordering my own party to follow me up in their own time along the monsoon drain, I therefore took my radio operator, and we began to move quickly forward through the firefight, which was now intensifying further along the drain. Crawling fast along a monsoon drain in full kit is quite tiring and can be very disorienting, particularly as shots were now striking the edge of the drain and occasionally skipping along inside it, ricocheting off the sides. We moved along the drain for what felt like about 200 meters and found ourselves close to the edge of a large river, near a stone bridge. I realized with a shock that we were right on the border, within about 20 meters of West Timor. The two of us had obviously attracted the enemy's attention, and we were taking quite a lot of fire. So we moved back a little, and then, with something of a terrifying lurch, dashed across the roadway together, over the top and down beyond into the area where I had seen OC Charlie disappear. We were about 5 feet apart. As we crossed, I felt about 20 enemy rounds pass between us. The impression was of loud, hot whip cracks a foot or so away. The fire seemed to be coming from houses on the other side of the river. I looked briefly at my radio operator, who had enormous round eyes and looked as haggard and sweat-drenched as I am sure I did. Sliding down off the roadway, we found ourselves huddling against an embankment in a small triangular garden area, about 150 by 75 meters, with a brick or stone wall ahead of us, lined by a series of large trees. Interestingly, in my mind's eye, as I look back on the event, I cannot remember any more than one or two very large trees, the trees I eventually sheltered behind. In fact, there were many trees, and in the video footage of the battle, you can see rounds striking them and knocking quite large branches off onto the ground. I cannot remember this at all, even though I must have jumped over the same falling branches as I ran forward through the firefight. But in my mind, the area was completely open and nakedly free of cover, and I saw only the open ground and the cover beyond it, as if my mind had simply tuned out everything not immediately relevant to its survival. Almost as soon as my radio operator and I arrived on the enemy side of the roadway, we realized that we were exposed to fire from the enemy positions across the river. A large burst of fire struck the embankment around the area where we had thrown ourselves, and my radio operator pushed my head down as another burst hit the area around our heads. It may have been at this point that I was hit in the left knee by a stone splinter from one of the bullet splashes. I felt nothing at the time and did not notice it until after the battle, when the artillery observer with my group pointed out the blood on my trouser leg, and I rolled it back to find a huge black bruise and a sharp little chip of stone sitting under my skin against the side of a bloodied kneecap. We clearly needed to move, as it seemed as if every militia position in the village was firing at us. One in particular, I was convinced it was the same guy who had fired at us as we crossed the road, seemed determined to hit us and was repeatedly firing bursts of machine gun fire at us and getting closer with every burst. So we dashed forward to the large trees on the far side of the garden, this time accompanied by the battalion intelligence officer and a combat cameraman who had appeared from out of the jungle behind us. At the trees, we found O.C. Charlie with his tactical headquarters, alive and well, but under significant pressure. At this point, I believe we killed the enemy who had been firing at us ever since we had left the monsoon drain. I say I believe we killed him, because to this day I don't have a clear memory of it. Indeed, it was only later when I cleaned my rifle and found that it had been fired and four rounds were missing from my magazine that I began to think back and started to remember the details. My impression is that we closed up to the stone wall, and I remember a feeling of fury, exactly like road rage, toward the militia who had been firing at us. I felt particularly protective of my radio operator, weighed down as he was with the heavy radio, and I have a blurry memory of waiting with murderous triumph for the same guerrilla fighter to pop up again in his firing position, and of several of us firing at once. I cannot say whether I hit anything, but he dropped out of sight behind the wall and did not appear again. My ears began to ring with a deafening loudness and did not stop for several days. Even now, several months later, they still ring occasionally. At this point, O.C. Charlie and I pulled out our maps, got under cover, and had a brief discussion in the shelter of the wall. It was clear to both of us that we were within 100 meters of the border and that at least some of those firing at us were Indonesian army forces as well as militia. I realized this with a dreadful sinking feeling, because killing militia was one thing, but a firefight with Indonesian regular troops could easily lead to a general war between Australia and Indonesia. We were sitting right on an international flashpoint. Tensions with Jakarta were on a razor's edge, the worst in 30 years. Our ships, submarines, and aircraft were playing hide-and-seek with theirs all over the Timor Sea. Our troops were intermixed with the remnants of the Indonesian occupation force throughout East Timor, and they outnumbered us 8-1. This was clearly a strategic crisis point and needed immediate action to quell it before it could spin out of control. My radio operator had been giving a running commentary to battalion headquarters throughout the engagement so far, and the commanding officer now wanted a direct situation report from me. I briefed him on the position, explained what had occurred, and said that I thought we were now close to the border and potentially facing the Indonesian army. He told me that brigade and force headquarters had been informed, and that we were to push forward and clear the village, killing any militia. It was clear to me that he was still working on the notion that we were at the outskirts of Matane in its fictional location well inside East Timor. I had mistakenly given my position about 300 meters to the east earlier in the firefight before seeing the bridge and realizing the mapping error, so this was my fault. Making him understand this in the heat of battle proved difficult, especially as Brigade had apparently directed him to close with and destroy the militia. It was at about this point that he released the Quick Reaction Force, the Assault Pioneer Platoon mounted in armored personnel carriers, to move forward and reinforce us. It would take them almost an hour to reach us, though, so I knew we had to act quickly to stop the present firefight before it escalated. We could hear trucks coming and going in the rear of the enemy position throughout the battle. At the time, I assumed the Indonesian armed forces were reinforcing their forward troops. As it turned out, this was actually the militia pulling out under covering fire of the Indonesian regulars, who covered them long enough to make good their escape and then began to slacken off their rate of fire. But at the time, I knew we were outnumbered and expected a flanking or rear attack from them at any moment. Having trained the Indonesians as commander of an advisory team a few years earlier, I knew their tactical style, and it was always to outflank aggressively. Shortly thereafter, what I expected seemed to be happening as a large burst of firing broke out behind us. After a hurried consultation with OC Charlie, I agreed to go back once again through the firefight, take charge of the rear part of the patrol, and fight off the outflanking move in our rear. As we dashed back across the open ground and over the roadway again, I had an extremely uncomfortable plucking sensation at the base of my neck as I smothered the fear of being shot in the back. I remember deciding at that point not to turn my back on the enemy again. However, even in that moment, I felt the enemy fire begin to slacken off as Charlie Company Tactical Headquarters opened fire again into the flanks of the enemy in the village, who seemed fixated on our forward platoon, which was pinned down on the home side of the stone bridge. The enemy seemed taken unawares by the headquarters engaging them from a flanking position in depth, and I believe it was at this point that the enemy suffered the bulk of their killed and wounded. With the firing behind our backs, back down the monsoon drain we went again, to the rear of the little perimeter the patrol had formed when the firefight began. Here, we found the two armed patrol vehicles closing up to our rear, having had a fleeting firefight with a group of militia fighters who had infiltrated to the rear of our location and popped out of the jungle ahead of the vehicles, whose gunners saw them crossing the road and engaged. This group of enemy, their outflanking move having been stopped by the patrol vehicles covering our rear, had then fled away from the firefight, eastward along the beach. As there was no longer an immediate threat to our rear, I gathered up everyone I could find, formed them into an ad hoc perimeter covering the rear of the triangular walled garden, and then ran forward through the firefight for the third time. As I did so, the fire began to die down into a lull. After again reaching the stone wall and having a brief, whispered discussion with O.C. Charlie, I agreed with him that we needed to try and organize a ceasefire. The Charlie Company medic, who spoke some Indonesian, had been calling on the enemy to put their weapons down for some time, but I am not sure they understood, and things were still on a hair trigger, with every weapon facing in and a tense Mexican standoff developing. I agreed with O.C. Charlie that I would take a small party forward across the bridge to negotiate. Gathering together my radio operator, the artillery forward observation officer who also commanded the civil affairs team, and his radio operator, I pulled everyone together into the shelter of the bridge abutment and briefed them on the plan. The combat cameraman joined us at this point, and I gave him permission to follow at a distance. I told the group to stay well behind me, and that if there was any firing, they were to go to ground, abandon me on the bridge, throw smoke grenades to create a smokescreen, then work their way back to the home side of the river. My theory was that as I was walking first, I would be most likely to be hit, and while that would be unfortunate for me, it would be disastrous if the whole party were killed in trying to recover me. We then set off, in a loose square formation, myself leading and calling out in Indonesian, "Jangan tembak, kami mau cakap saja." Don't shoot, we just want to talk. I remember feeling faintly ridiculous and wishing we had something white to fly to indicate our intention to parley, but we had nothing available and so simply moved forward with our weapons in outstretched arms, hoping the Indonesians would not misunderstand our intent. For me, this was the most frightening part of the whole engagement. My heart was thumping so hard I could barely walk, and I felt shaky in the legs, with a dry mouth that tasted of dust and ashes. After all the fire that had gone down, the deafening noise of the firefight, and the killing and wounding of people, I felt the afternoon silence flooding back, pressing in on me, and I wanted simply to take cover rather than walking blindly forward like an idiot into the unknown. Particularly, I felt worried that my little party would be engaged and that my radio operator or one of the others would be killed, and it would be my fault. Alternatively, the Indonesians might misinterpret our action as an attempt to surrender and take us prisoner. Having seen the dismembered bodies of local people who had been captured by the militia and which had washed up on the beach over the past few weeks, this prospect did not fill me with confidence. As we came around the slight curve in the bridge, we saw an Indonesian Army light machine gun team lying on the side of the road near the first houses, struggling with their weapon, which had jammed. I do not know if they would have fired if they had been able, but by the time they cleared the jam, the cameraman had appeared, and they clearly thought better of it. By this stage, my heart felt as if it was knocking a hole in my ribs, and I was keyed up to an enormous extent. Then, a few yards ahead, around the corner appeared an Indonesian army lieutenant, a police captain, and several Indonesian regular soldiers, clearly, from their uniforms, members of the Indonesian Strategic Reserve Command. As we closed up with them, Australian troops began appearing out of the tree line also, including the lead platoon commander and several other soldiers. The Indonesians were smiling, and with enormous relief, I closed up with them and we began to talk. As I came close, I put my rifle down on the ground and walked forward unarmed, with arms at my sides, my radio operator picking up the rifle behind me. The firefight was over, but the hardest part of the day was still to come. It felt as if it had only been a few minutes since the start of the firefight, but glancing at my watch, I realized it was after 4 p.m. The gun battle had lasted almost 90 minutes. The negotiation. As we met, I briefly grasped hands with the senior Indonesian police and army officers, touching my heart in the Javanese style. We were all smiling with relief, although the senior police officer looked sullen. After exchanging greetings, I said that there seemed to have been some kind of misunderstanding and asked the army officer, a first lieutenant, why his troops had fired on us. He said, with disarming frankness, that we had caught his people by surprise, and they had reacted by firing at us because they did not know who we were. By this stage, no militia were visible anymore, and I wanted to confirm the ceasefire before we discussed the guerrilla presence. We were speaking in Indonesian, but I was very conscious of the Australian Army cameraman recording the negotiation. Very useful from one point of view, but still disconcerting, knowing that any mistake I made would be permanently recorded and widely known. I was still very stressed, extremely hot, incredibly thirsty, as one always is after a firefight, still sweating and shaking slightly from the after effects of the gunfight and the fear I had experienced leading the party across the bridge. I paused for a drink of water, which one of my sergeants, a mortar fire controller who had been with me through the firefight, kindly offered me from his water bottle. I took a couple of deep breaths and then continued negotiating. The Indonesians were indeed Strategic Reserve Command troops, from Java, clearly unused to Timor and unfamiliar with their location. The senior officer, Lieutenant Eddie, said they had only been there for less than 2 days. He was quite unclear as to his location, but was sure he had been told that his position was in West Timor. His impression was that the border ran through the center of the stone bridge and that the contact had literally been a cross-border shoot with our people on the East Timor side and his people on the west. Still, he had no map, there was no visible border marking, and I was still at this point fairly sure that we were at least 100 meters inside East Timor. On a positive note, he admitted that his men had fired first and that they had started the firefight. This was important, since, ambiguously enough, because of the way the international community, led by the United States, had pressured Indonesia to permit the international intervention, we were ostensibly supposed to be cooperating with the Indonesians in putting down the militia. There were even Indonesian liaison officers at Interfet headquarters in Dili, listening to the contact unfold over the radio and tracking it in the command post. At this point, I and the Indonesian commander had reached agreement on a ceasefire, each promising that we would not advance beyond our present positions, would not engage each other further, and would withdraw from immediate contact as soon as we had confirmed the situation and completed battlefield clearance, the process of cleaning up dead, wounded, weapons, and expended ordnance that always has to happen after a firefight. I felt considerable relief at this, even though the consequences of the firefight still had to be worked through. At least we had agreed on a ceasefire, and the immediate strategic danger of war with Indonesia was averted. In terms of casualties, we had seen 2 stretchers being carried out of the houses, at least one of which contained a dead man. I was unable to determine whether he was militia, police, or army, but the Indonesians later admitted to the loss of a policeman killed. We quickly offered the Indonesians the use of the medical team who had accompanied our patrol to treat their casualties, but they declined the assistance. This puzzled and saddened me at the time, because it almost certainly cost the unnecessary death of at least one of the Indonesian wounded who could have been treated, stabilized, and evacuated by our people on the spot, but was instead trucked to the primitive hospital in Atambua. This was an hour's drive away, and at least one of the wounded did not survive the journey. There were at least 2 other casualties on the Indonesian side, according to reporting we received later. So this means a total of 1 to 5 people killed or wounded on the Indonesian side. On our side, we had no serious casualties, despite having been outnumbered, probably because we had remained largely static and in cover, and the Indonesians' aim had been quite high in the initial burst of fire. Strictly speaking, the position of the border was a secondary issue. At this time, East Timor was still legally part of Indonesia. The Indonesian parliament had yet to vote on the issue, and Australia had recognized East Timor as the 27th province of Indonesia more than a decade earlier. So there was, in fact, no international border involved. Rather, it was an administrative boundary between 2 village districts within Indonesia, lying on the interprovincial boundary between Nusa Tenggara Timur Province and East Timor Province. However, Interfet had agreed with the Indonesian army representatives in Dili that we would not cross the boundary, and it seems that even the level of cooperation between Interfet and the Indonesian military in East Timor, largely mythical as it was not replicated in Nusa Tenggara Timur Province. It was clear to me, though, that public opinion in Indonesia and Australia would consider this an international border issue rather than simply a case of 2 ostensible allies being drawn into a gunfight by the presence of local guerrillas. So we needed to clearly establish the position of the interprovincial boundary and, if possible, record the Indonesians admitting that we were still on the East Timor side. By this time, the tactical situation had changed. The assault pioneers had arrived, mounted in the big M113 armored personnel carriers, and were deploying around the walled garden and along the road. This substantially increased our troop presence in the battle area and seemed quite intimidating for the Indonesians. The noise and gravitas of the armored vehicles as they maneuvered and positioned themselves, with their deep-throated engines and heavy machine guns, seemed to stamp our side's ownership and dominance on the area and had an obvious intimidatory effect on the Indonesian negotiators. The press had also now arrived, in the form of several TV news media crews, as well as the Army combat camera team who had been with us throughout the battle. A small crowd of media people had begun to gather on the home side of the stone bridge, getting in people's way and filming the negotiations as they continued. I asked the forward observer and his civil military operations team to move them somewhat to the rear and maintain control over them. This was partly for their own safety, as the situation was still a relatively tense standoff, but mainly to ensure that we controlled the information flow about the battle for as long as possible. I had no illusions that we would be able to maintain control for any length of time. The civilian mobile phone system was still functioning, and almost certainly, at least some of the reporters had already filed an initial report. I was conscious that at this moment, even as the battlefield clearance was still underway, General Cosgrove in Dili and the Australian government in Canberra probably already knew in some detail about the firefight. They almost certainly knew more than our own brigade commander, who was still embarked on a Navy amphibious ship in transit to his new headquarters location at Suai. There was still a possibility that the incident, if reported in an inflammatory way, could lead to a direct shooting war with Indonesia, so it was imperative that we gain positive control over the media information flow as soon as possible and put our own spin on the reporting of it. Another change was the arrival of a senior Indonesian officer, the Atambua Military District Commander, Colonel Sigit Yuwono. He arrived looking very dapper in an office uniform rather than combat fatigues, with a silver-tipped swagger cane and a rolled wall map of the area. However, he was also clearly agitated, and the corners of his map showed traces of masking tape where it had been torn from the wall of a command post or office. He and I laid our respective maps on the roadway near the bridge, and, poring over them, went again over the same issues I had discussed with Lieutenant Eddy before Colonel Sigit's arrival. We then moved on to a more detailed discussion of the border issue. All of this was happening in full sight of the media, and I was conscious of being in public view. So I made an effort to use both Indonesian and English for all key points, to ensure that both the domestic Indonesian media and the global English language media received the same basic information. I had learned on a previous operational tour as an intelligence officer with the British Army contingent in the UN peacekeeping force in Cyprus that even when apparently a very long distance from the action, TV cameras and microphones can pick up an extremely high degree of detail during an incident. The discussion over the map turned out to be useful, because on the Indonesian map it was clear that there was a major discrepancy between Colonel Sigit's map, which was a Dutch map from the mid-1930s, and the Indonesian published maps that we were carrying. The Dutch map had form lines only, with no topographical contours or grid references, but it showed Mataen very clearly as a major village on the West Timor side of the border, with a river running immediately to its east and a bridge marked as the border crossing. This matched the verbal account of the border that the Indonesian junior officers had given us, but was entirely different from the depiction on our maps, which showed Mataen as a minor village well inside East Timor, with the river to its west. Clearly, either the border had moved at some point, the village had moved, which happens in the tropics more often than one might suppose. The river had changed its course. One or both maps were simply incorrect, or all of the above. All this discussion was played out in front of the media. After some time, I agreed with Colonel Sigit that we would make a joint statement to the media. I agreed to this because, for some reason, the Indonesians seemed very willing to admit that their troops had started the firefight and that our troops, regardless of how the maps were interpreted, had at all times been inside East Timor. What they were completely unwilling to admit was the presence of the militia or any relationship between the guerrillas and the Indonesian regular troops and police. This was understandable, as this would have been a public admission that they had been training and supporting the militia and would have undermined their whole strategic position. In fact, of course, all through the operation we had seen the closest possible cooperation between the militia and the Indonesian regulars. For example, The very day after this firefight, my company ambushed an 11-man infiltration party near the Nunura River, a major infiltration route, then and now. This party was made up of militia, but was equipped with the latest Indonesian army weapons and equipment and led by 2 Indonesian Special Forces soldiers. Other information made it clear that the battle had involved a significant militia presence. For example, I had just debriefed the leading Australian section commander, that is, squad leader, and forward scout on the initial moments of the battle. It seems that as the leading section rounded the corner, they saw a man on the road, level with the first houses of the village, armed with an SKS or M16 rifle, and wearing camouflage pants and the t-shirt of the Besi Merah Putih militia group. The moment he saw the patrol, this guerrilla fighter opened fire on them. They went to ground and returned fire, and then a storm of small arms fire burst out of the houses in the village. Similarly, OC Charlie had moved forward as I was beginning the negotiation on the other side of the village. In doing so, he encountered 2 men dressed entirely in khaki, a common militia uniform color not worn by either the Indonesian army or police, and armed with SKS rifles, a common militia weapon not possessed by the Indonesian army. All of this, in the absence of a militia prisoner or corpse, was purely circumstantial evidence, but, along with the hurried evacuation of the militia by truck, which our forward section had witnessed, the evidence was nevertheless very strong that the Indonesian regulars had been protecting and supporting a sizable guerrilla group. Given the information spin issues associated with the engagement, I thought that we should try to get a public admission on the border issue from the Indonesian commander before the situation developed too far. It was probably too much to expect any discussion of the militia issue. After some discussion, I managed to convince him to agree on a 4-point joint statement to the effect that the 2 sides' maps were different and showed the border differently. The firefight was initiated by the Indonesian troops when the Australians were still in East Timor, and neither side crossed the border at any stage. The Australian troops returned fire from the East Timor side of the border. The situation was now stable, and both sides had agreed to a ceasefire and to maintain their current positions. Having agreed on this joint statement, Colonel Sigit and I then called an impromptu press conference on the bridge, surrounded by the media crews. This would normally have required higher headquarters approval, but there was a real-time imperative to get our side of the story out before the civilian media began to spin it, so I made the judgment to go ahead on my own initiative. I later got some sharp criticism from my commanding officer about this, but I still think it was the right thing to do. Sigit had made it clear that he was about to give a press conference, whether I agreed or not, so if I had not taken part, the Indonesian version of the story would have gone out before ours, with their interpretation only. So I agreed to take part. We made our joint statement, he speaking in Indonesian and I making the same points in English and confirming his statement. We then answered a few questions. By this stage, my injured knee was stiffening badly. It was almost sunset, and I was absolutely exhausted after the 90-minute gun battle and the subsequent drawn-out negotiations. The Quick Reaction Force commander had deployed his platoon and the armored personnel carriers around the battle site, and battlefield clearance, on our side at any rate, was complete. Charlie Company were shaking out into a dispersed formation in the general area and preparing to pull back a little to prevent any further outbreak of fighting. After a brief consultation with the commanding officer by radio, he directed me to return to Balipo and brief him in person. Driving up the winding hill road to Balipo in one of the open Land Rover patrol vehicles, I began to experience a reaction after combat, a trembling, shivering fit of chills, much like an attack of fever, as well as physical weakness, particularly in the legs, thirst, and gritty eyes. Luckily, I had experienced this before and knew what to expect, and I also had a 45-minute drive to get over it. I was nevertheless extremely tired by the time the Land Rover drove through the archway into the stone courtyard of the old Portuguese colonial fortress of Balibo Castle. The Aftermath. In the deepening twilight, the whole castle was buzzing with excitement, with a small group gathered around the underground command post doorway, listening to the radio traffic relating to the battle. Other onlookers, mainly headquarters people, were standing around the courtyard, and a gaggle of staff officers, along with the commanding officer, were standing by the battle map, which was taped to the damp, dungeon-like wall of the command post. With the intelligence officer, I briefed the commanding officer in detail on the engagement, using the big wall map in the Tactical Operations Center, and we then sat down to write a contact report for Brigade and Interfet headquarters. In retrospect, this was premature, as the report contained a number of inaccuracies, not least the actual point where the firefight had started and the location of the village of Matane. The number of enemy casualties was also still unclear at this stage. Unfortunately, as a formal contact report, this document entered the official record of the campaign. Subsequently, as we were able to walk over the scene in daylight and reconstruct the events, it became clear that some aspects of the report were wrong. To Brigade Headquarters, and perhaps to General Cosgrove, it thus appeared that we had held something back, or falsified details of the initial report. This was not the case, but it made higher headquarters suspicious, and contributed to a more thorough grilling when the investigation began. By the time I had finished the contact report, and it had been sent, the moon was already up, the night was very dark, and the castle was quiet. The commanding officer told me to go to bed. Normally, I would have had a 3 to 4 hour command post shift to do, involving sitting in the command post and supervising the clerks, radio operators, and staff officers through the night. In fact, this was the only night of the operation, apart from nights spent out on patrol with my company, when I missed doing a shift. But I was grateful for the break. My sleeping space was tucked into a corner of the castle wall, under a waterproof shelter sheet known as a hutchie, and up on a small stone ledge. Making my way there, I finally removed all my combat equipment. I was still shaking, primarily from the chill of the night air after taking off my body armor, but also with the tail end of my reaction to combat. It was dark, so I was unable, for reasons of night battle discipline, which in the Australian Army forbids cooking or the use of light after dark in a forward area, to cook a meal or make myself a cup of coffee. So I had a biscuit and some cold tinned tuna for dinner, drank some water, sat for a while staring at the wall with a blank mind, and then rolled myself in my silk sleeping bag liner and tried to go to sleep. This proved difficult, as I kept replaying the events of the day in my mind, seeing again the flash of fire and the movement of the troops, shuddering as I remembered walking across the bridge. A thunderstorm was playing about the distant mountaintops along the border, and the thunder and lightning unsettled me, sounding like a distant battle. My knee was also hurting considerably and was stiffened by the wound from the stone chip, which I had managed to extract without difficulty, using my clasp knife. The enemy was still occasionally infiltrating right into Balibo Town at this stage of the operation, and there may have been at least one alarm during the night due to actual or suspected probing. In any case, in the early hours I woke with a start and saw in the bright moonlight what I thought were two guerrillas standing about 4 feet away, looking at me. I snatched up my rifle, which, when sleeping, I kept loaded between my body and the wall, attached by a lanyard to my wrist. I was about to put a burst of fire into the enemy when I realized that I was looking at the two young banana plants, each about 6 feet high, that grew next to my sleeping spot. It was lucky I did not fire, as I would almost certainly have hit those sleeping on the opposite side of the castle courtyard. After giving myself this unnecessary and rather embarrassingly unprofessional fright, I spent the rest of the night sitting wedged into my corner of the castle wall, knees drawn up, unable to sleep. The investigation. The next few days turned out to be unequivocally the worst of my army career, indeed of my life up until that time. By mid-morning, it was clear that the previous day's firefight was considered a major international incident and that there would be an investigation by Interfet headquarters and possibly also by the UN. Reports of the battle were on the radio and apparently on TV, on the internet, and in world newspapers as well. One paper, I believe it was the front page of the Queensland daily newspaper, the Courier Mail, carried a large, full-color photograph of me negotiating with Colonel Siggett and the banner headline, Brink of War, with an article describing the state of extreme international tension between Australia and Indonesia. This was not good, to say the least. The process of the investigation is perhaps better described as an inquisition. It occurred in three stages. First, I drove down to Batu Gidde with the commanding officer, and he and I discussed the battle with OC Charlie. The commanding officer told us that investigators were coming down from Dili, the first time anyone had yet visited our battalion from the headquarters, and advised OC Charlie and I to be completely honest and open with them, as there was nothing to be afraid of. This, of course, immediately caused alarm bells to start ringing in our minds. Later, we met with the three investigators from Interfet headquarters. Two colonels, one an operations officer, the other the senior military policeman in Timor, and a military police warrant officer. The atmosphere was frostily adversarial, and it was immediately clear to all of us that we were in serious trouble. Each of us was interviewed separately and then made to write a detailed statement on his part in the engagement. The investigators had watched the combat camera crew's video footage of the incident. We had not, and the television news footage, and therefore had us at a disadvantage. They continually corrected our recollection in matters of detail, using phrases like, "Contrary to what you just said, the video evidence shows," and so on. This was extremely uncomfortable, as none of us had any intention of misleading the investigators. Indeed, before the interrogations began, we rather naively felt quite satisfied with our performance during the battle. The key issue appeared to be the border, which we all felt was a bit odd, since there was in fact no international border there, and in any case, there was pretty clear topographical evidence that the maps were inaccurate. Certainly, from my point of view, the key issue was that the militia had been at Matane in strength and had fired on us first, and that we had returned fire, killing several without loss to ourselves. But from the investigators' point of view, this had been primarily an international boundary issue, and it was clear that there was a major political storm going on back in Australia, with questions in Parliament, criticism of the government in the media, and a sharp exchange of diplomatic notes with the Indonesians. After this initial grilling, we drove forward along the coast road to a point just short of the incident site, where I dismounted and walked forward alone, as I was the only linguist, and we needed to talk to the Indonesian garrison on the bridge site to ensure there was no chance of another clash with them. I found it extremely unnerving to walk forward alone through the previous day's battle site toward the bridge. The Indonesians were on the bridge and waved to indicate that they were comfortable with our presence. The investigators then came forward to join me, and we walked over the ground with them. Again, now that we were able to walk around in the open, rather than crawling in the monsoon drain or taking cover behind the wall, our recollection of events proved somewhat inaccurate. For example, my whole calculation of the location where the firefight began, based on dead reckoning and counting paces while crawling up the monsoon drain, turned out to be incorrect. In fact, we were about 200 yards further forward than I had thought. Similarly, already mentioned, there was the matter of the trees that I had completely failed to notice while under fire. The initial investigations were followed a few days later with a joint UN border commission with representatives from Australia, Indonesia, and other countries with UN observers in Timor. We were called in to discuss the incident with the commission members, a process that involved a fairly tortuous discussion about the negotiation phase down at the battle site. Ultimately, the commission reported in detail on the position of the border, broadly confirming the Indonesian view of the border location, but stating that the contact had occurred entirely in East Timor. there was no mention of militia. I have always considered this commission verdict, more or less, a political whitewash. It was typical UN behavior, similar to the behavior I had witnessed time and again on the Green Line in Cyprus, and to a lesser extent in Bougainville. If the commission's interpretation of the border was correct, then at least the forward scout and possibly the whole of our lead section were inside West Timor once the firefight ended. This was clearly not the case at the start of the battle, when we were all inside East Timor, even by the Indonesian interpretation, but it was certainly so by the end, when we had advanced some way through the firefight. My small team had definitely penetrated the border when crossing the bridge to negotiate. Conversely, the masses of evidence pointing to a significant militia presence during and before the firefight seemed to have been completely ignored. It seems likely to me, based on previous UN experience, that the Commission decided to seek a resolution through compromise. We won't mention the militia, you won't complain about the border being crossed in hot pursuit. The second firefight, the militia who appeared to our rear attempting to outflank us, were cut off by the vehicles covering our rear, and then escaped by fleeing along the beach, was simply ignored as if it had never happened. The results of the battle. Particularly in operational and intelligence matters, it is very difficult to know the effects of your own actions. The enemy never tells you the effect you are having, and you have to piece together the results of any operation or intelligence action from a patchwork of incidental detail that does not emerge until much later. With the advantage of hindsight, the results of the battle seem to have been relatively positive for Interfet. Later in the operation, we picked up a defector who had been part of the guerrilla group at Matane that day. He said that the village had been used as a militia training area for some weeks before we arrived, and he named an Indonesian Special Forces sergeant, already known to me through another source, who had been responsible for training and supporting the militia. Matane was a rallying point for guerrillas exfiltrating out of East Timor once we arrived, and the Besi Meraputi and Aitarak militia groups both had elements there. These groups had been training at Matane in preparation for an infiltration into East Timor. This defector confirmed for us that the militia had withdrawn from Matane during the battle, cancelled the planned infiltration, and relocated to a new training camp outside Atambua, about another 10 miles further back from the border inside West Timor. Another captured infiltrator told us that there had been several militia camps right on the border in early October, and that they had all moved back after the Matane Bridge battle, so that they were now located at a distance of 10 to 20 kilometers inside Nusa Tenggara Timur province. The threatened militia offensive never occurred. Some local people with contacts across the border told us that the offensive had been planned but cancelled after Matane, which had disrupted the preparation for it. I always found this hard to believe. Mounting a major offensive of this type would have been extremely foolish for the militia, and our aggressive patrolling after we arrived may well have convinced them not to take us on, but rather to wait us out, by holding on until we inevitably left East Timor, before going on the offensive. Conversely, keeping the fear of a militia counteroffensive uppermost in our minds was in the local people's interest. It kept us there, protecting them. So our actions at Matane may have prevented the offensive, but I doubt that any such offensive was ever really intended. In a more general sense, we had given a good account of ourselves in our first major clash with Indonesian regulars, police, and militia. Although there were other firefights, this was the largest and the only one where large numbers of both Indonesian regular troops and militia fighters were involved. We had identified the center of gravity for the militia as their relationship with the Indonesian military and the support they derived from their sponsors. At Matane, the militia saw their protectors taking a kicking, and we know from sources that remain classified today that this led to a loss of confidence between the two groups and contributed to the subsequent political disintegration of the militia movement, hence its failure to evolve into a full-blown insurgency. On a formal intergovernment level, the firefight made people realize the risk of having an ill-defined land border. First, Interfet declared a self-imposed moratorium on ground operations within 1,000 meters of the border. This was a real restriction on our operations in some areas, particularly for my company, which spent almost the whole of the campaign in a remote area of jungle right on the frontier. But we were always able to get a dispensation from force headquarters when we needed one. A joint commission studied the border. Our topographical survey squadron mapped it in great detail and confirmed the errors in the maps we had all been using. Areas of dispute and discrepancy were identified, and the two sides, and later the UN and the East Timor government, began to resolve them. Agreed crossing points, known as junction points, were established to control movement and information across the border. These still exist and seem to have become a permanent feature of the western border area. So the short answer to the question, what were the results of the battle, is that we don't really know. The evidence we do have, however, suggests that the firefight may have pushed the militia back from the border, hampered preparations for infiltration, undermined the guerrillas' confidence in the regular Indonesian military, and possibly led to the cancellation of a planned militia counterstroke. We do know that the battle led to the formalization and detailed mapping of a previously ill-defined border, removing potential sources of friction between Indonesia and newly independent East Timor. Lessons learned. Although the overall results of the firefight were broadly positive, the engagement was most definitely not one of my better performances, and I took from it several lessons worth noting. I have listed them here in no particular order. Combat performance. It is a truism that people never perform as well in actual combat as they do in training. Certainly, training comes through and influences people's behavior, helping them adjust to an infinitely more complex and hostile environment. But fear, exhaustion, uncertainty, in Clausewitz's word, friction, undermines performance. Luckily, the same factors affect the enemy, so if you cope better with friction and the inevitable degradation of performance than the enemy can, you come out on top. If I consider my own performance on the day of Matane, it was certainly not one of my better days. But it seems the Indonesian forces and militia were having an even worse day, so things turned out all right for us. Fear. Matane was not my first firefight. I had previously experienced hostile action on other operational deployments. But Matane was by far the heaviest engagement of my experience to that date. Of course, it pales into insignificance compared to what I and thousands of my peers experienced subsequently in Iraq and Afghanistan. I noticed on that day, and subsequently on other occasions, that troops in their first firefight, particularly young, well-trained regular troops, tend to experience less fear than more seasoned troops who have already seen combat. I suspect this is because inexperienced troops do not have as clear an understanding of what could possibly happen to them, so they feel more invulnerable. As their experience of combat develops, troops tend to take fewer risks and to consider their options more carefully. They have seen people getting killed and injured and have a much clearer perception of the risks they run. Hence, their tactical behavior tends to be less reckless and more considered. Youth is a factor here. That sense of immortality and invulnerability that defines young men can actually be a precious commodity in combat. I have watched even very young soldiers grow old in weeks after a few firefights, while their older peers who have not experienced the same intensity remain callow. The quiet, self-contained confidence of experienced troops is ideal for a complex operation, say an ambush or a cordon and search, but in a major one-off combat engagement, there is no substitute for youth, and inexperience, provided the standard of training is high, can actually be an advantage. This was not a major factor in Timor, where combat action was relatively infrequent, but it would be a significant issue in a more intensive operation. Patrol planning. It is clear to me and will surely be obvious to the listener that our patrol planning for this operation was deeply flawed. At the time, given the apparent accuracy of the information and the fact that it appeared time-sensitive, we saw a degree of urgency in the situation and a need to mount the patrol quickly. Could we, in fact, have waited another 24 hours? With the benefit of hindsight, I suspect we could have, and this would have allowed more detailed reconnaissance and deliberate planning rather than the more hurried process we actually adopted. This might have revealed the error in our maps, as well as the presence of significant Indonesian regular military forces alongside the militia, and might have given us pause. At the very least, we might have gone in with armored vehicles in the patrol from the outset instead of using them as backup. Navigation. Poor maps are no excuse for poor navigation. Our mapping products are outstanding in Australia in terms of accuracy and production quality, so that we become spoiled and expect to rely on our maps. In most of the world, this is a mistake. Most maps have neither the accuracy nor the clarity of the maps we use in training, and when we work with poorer maps, maps that require a degree of skepticism and interpretation in use, we can be caught out, as I and the other Australian commanders undoubtedly were on this occasion. My dead reckoning in the jungle was inaccurate, due to the fact that we entered and left the woods at no fixed, recognizable landmarks. I was not carrying a GPS, but in hindsight I should have insisted on a satellite fix from one of the other officers as soon as we hit the road again. I continued counting paces along the road and trying to identify my location using map to ground, but I was at least 30 seconds to a minute too late in realizing our true position, and as it turned out, this was long enough that the firefight became inevitable. True enough, I was not in overall command, and neither OC Charlie nor the lead platoon commander spotted the error either, but that is not the point. Navigation in combat conditions is not like navigation in training. There is nothing like someone shooting at you to make you lose count of paces and bearings, and we need to train our young commanders accordingly. We must give them experience of working with poorer maps and of making navigational decisions under stress. We must also develop skills in geographic intelligence and ensure that commanders are aware of the need to interpret, assess, and evaluate topographic data. Contact drills. One benefit of contact drills, the set of tactical plays that infantry small unit tactics prescribe for firefights of this nature, is that they relieve the soldier of the obligation to think about his actions at the moment of the first shot. This is invaluable, because if you think rationally about your options under the stress of a fight or flight moment like that, you may well decide that flight is the better option. As it was, an efficient contact drill brought us all into cover within moments, all moving forward toward the enemy and laying down fire. It allowed us to regain the mental high ground following the enemy's initiation of the firefight. The fact that the Indonesians fired high probably helped, but I have no doubt that an effective contact drill saved lives at Matane. Contact drills are considered somewhat basic and boring in infantry units. On the contrary, we should be doing them every day, in a variety of terrain and tactical situations, until they become absolute second nature. Weapons employment. The enemy's marksmanship in this engagement was exceptionally poor. They fired literally thousands of rounds over the 90 minutes of the firefight without hitting a single Australian. Their fire was high throughout the contact, often a sign of inexperience, and they laid down so much fire that they actually damaged their own situational awareness. They were making so much noise and creating such obscuration of the battlefield through dust and knocked down vegetation that they could not hear or see us, hence could not detect our movement and return fire until we started to kill them. This fact allowed us to get away with a fairly poor standard of marksmanship ourselves. Our shooting was better than theirs, but it was not good. Much of it was high, particularly in the initial stages, and we made little use of our heavier weapons, such as rockets and 40-millimeter grenades. We did so mainly in order to avoid damage to civilian property and out of deliberate restraint due to our uncertainty about whether civilians were in the village, but we could still have employed smoke, flanking fire, and point destruction, discussed below, to greater effect. In hindsight, a heavier weight of fire from us in the early stages of the conflict may have foreshortened it, avoiding much of the protracted firefight and potentially saving some Indonesian lives. Point suppression. The majority of Indonesian casualties seem to have been inflicted by tactical headquarters or my detachment of specialist troops rather than the leading platoon itself. I found this highly instructive because our doctrine tells us that the lead element in a firefight should go to ground, take cover, lay down a heavy suppressing fire, and thus allow the other elements to maneuver and defeat the enemy. The opposite was true in this firefight. The lead element was pinned down during the battle and unable to effectively suppress the enemy. Instead, it was elements such as headquarters, firing from a position in depth and undetected by the enemy, who did the damage. There was virtually no maneuver in the sense of movement, but a precisely applied weight of accurate fire from concealed positions in depth. This led me to begin developing the idea of unobtrusive killing areas in urban fighting, areas that appear safe but are actually vulnerable to fire from well-placed, undetected enemy positions in depth. Results from simulations support the idea that such unobtrusive killing areas are where most casualties are lost in this type of fighting, and that undetected weapons firing from depth positions do the killing, not maneuver by forward elements. Personal equipment. Many of us carried far too much personal equipment throughout the campaign. This battle was no exception. I had learned on previous operations to minimize personal equipment, but even those of us with previous experience were still carrying far too much kit. The ridiculous weights carried on initial deployment, two-thirds of body weight or more in many cases, were actually quite unnecessary. As described, the loads were so excessive that the soldiers needed water resupply at least daily. The justification for carrying such enormous weights was that the resupply system could not be trusted to supply us for several days, yet we relied on that very resupply system for our daily water resupply. If the system could reliably supply water, a bulky and heavy item shipped all the way from Australia, then surely we could have relied on it for other things also. None of us managed to eat a meal of any kind for the first 48 hours, yet we all landed in Dili with 3 days' combat rations that remained uneaten. We need to recapture our traditional austerity in our approach to equipment. We are in danger of getting soft and literally killing ourselves and our soldiers with kindness. Protective equipment. Similarly, throughout the campaign, our heavy helmets and body armor made it impossible to catch or keep up with the lightly equipped enemy fighters who carried a rifle and one water bottle at most. They consistently outran, outmaneuvered, and outpaced us. The official reason given for the requirement to wear protective equipment was duty of care. In other words, the generals and politicians didn't want to have to explain to someone's parents that he had been shot while not wearing body armor. But the very weight and bulk of the armor tired us, destroyed our agility, and made us a bigger target for longer. At Matane, no one was hit by enemy fire, but our lack of agility in the firefight may have resulted, at least in part, from the fact that we were burdened and dehydrated from wearing the heavy, stifling armor. I don't expect that the Defense Department will accept the risk of doing away with body armor anytime soon. Hence, the clear lesson here is that we must train constantly in the armor, develop upper body core strength, adapt to the extra burden, and ruthlessly minimize other kit. Webbing equipment. Before Matane, I carried typical infantry commander's webbing, lots of navigational equipment, maps and orders and plans kit, as well as minimal ammunition, water and first aid equipment. I wore issue belt webbing, but supplemented this with British issue Northern Ireland chest webbing when on patrol, with extra water and ammunition. Many people who wore chest or vest webbing in firefights, including Matane, came away wanting to ditch it and revert to the issue belt webbing. This was because the chest webbing, by placing the pouches directly below your chest, lifts you an extra 10 centimeters or so off the ground. This sounds like a minuscule amount, but with someone shooting at you, it feels enormous. With belt webbing, it is the pouches that are lifted off the ground, while you can hug the earth to your heart's content. After Matane, I wore the lightest possible belt kit, with ammunition, water, and large amounts of medical kit only. My commander's kit and minimal survival equipment I stuffed into my pockets. I slept out many nights in the jungle with only this equipment, suffering no significant inconvenience. The lesson here, again, is that we are killing ourselves with comfort and convenience, a little more austerity and a willingness to suffer discomfort in order to better kill the enemy would be well worthwhile. Media. Handling of the media during and after this contact was a key element in limiting the damage caused to our relationship with Indonesia, preventing the outbreak of war, and generating information dominance over the militia and the Indonesian army. It was not until afterward that I attended a media awareness course, but in hindsight, I am not sure how much good the standard media course would have been in any case. The standard course, as conducted at Staff College, focuses on routine interviews, press conferences, and handling sensitive political issues. By contrast, the training I found most valuable was an exercise I did with the British Army while preparing for Cyprus. This was a simulated combat situation with numerous issues competing for one's attention, including a real-life BBC television crew led by the well-known war correspondent Kate Adey. In addition to handling the media, I had to make tactical decisions under pressure, handle the information operations side of the incident, and maneuver my troops. This was the most pressure I had experienced in training during my time in the Army until that time, and the experience stood me in excellent stead at Matane. I believe such training should be mandatory for all combat arms officers. The other lesson from the media aspect of this incident was that the armed forces no longer control information flow on the battlefield. Our hierarchical command and control system functioned well, but the networked media reporting system outpaced it dramatically. This does not necessarily mean that we need to mimic the media system. Theirs is purely a reporting network, whereas ours requires decision-making, assessment, and response at various levels. But it does mean that we need to recognize that sources and flows of information around the battlefield are not ours to control. We must still seek to apply information and influence to the greatest extent possible, but we must also recognize that the chaos and confusion inherent in this situation is ultimately outside our control. Language. Language skills were critical here. Without sound language skills, including interpreting and negotiating skills, we could not have organized a ceasefire, confirmed the border location, neutralized unfavorable media coverage, or ultimately avoided the threat of wider conflict. But language capability in and of itself was not enough. We also needed cultural understanding of the Indonesians, the sort of understanding that went into our efforts to avoiding exacerbating their loss of face, sidestepping the militia issue, diffusing the standoff situation, as well as area studies knowledge of how Timorese and Indonesian society works. Importantly, we needed to combine these skills with professional competence. We needed not specialist linguists, but bilingual infantry and intelligence operators. Given the current Australian military language training and management system, we do have some of these people, but nowhere near enough. Moreover, the people we do have emerge largely by accident, without centralized or coherent planning by the military. If we want to be successful in future, we cannot afford to continue leaving this to chance. Intelligence work. Our application of field intelligence improved over the course of the campaign. By the end, we had a well-developed system of field and human intelligence, and I had a personal network of local sources and agents, a major asset in prosecuting counter-militia operations. In the early stages, and at the time of this incident, however, field intelligence was still rudimentary and based almost entirely on interrogations of militia detainees, defector debriefings, and casual contacts with local sources. Because we had been in the area of operations only a short time, we had limited collateral information and limited ability to judge the reliability of sources, and many of our best sources were yet to be developed. In particular, senior commanders were unwilling to place any reliance on local sources and tended to place too much reliance on assets controlled by us. This is typical of inexperienced commanders who confuse our degree of control over a particular collection asset or agency with the accuracy of its information. Over-reliance on technical means to the exclusion of human sources, requiring more finesse in interpretation, also led to distorted intelligence. In the case of Matane, the basic intelligence picture existing before the battle, which was derived primarily from local human sources, proved to be almost completely correct. It was impossible to verify the rumors of an impending militia counteroffensive, but every aspect of the information that could be verified was proved accurate. The sole inaccuracy, and it was one we introduced ourselves through reliance on mapping and failure to ask the locals for directions or use local guides, was the location of the village in relation to the border. Yet, because of senior commanders' inexperience in intelligence work, this error, actually our own, was blamed on local sources, and we had great difficulty convincing the commanding officer to even consider local information thereafter, or to engage with local community leaders, a great opportunity lost. I also had difficulty gaining permission to raise and train a group of local guides, although I eventually managed to create a small, local, irregular group under the control of my intelligence, surveillance, and reconnaissance team. More familiarization with intelligence methods and procedures, as well as a larger number of professionally trained intelligence officers within infantry and other combat arms units, would have avoided this problem. We must remedy this issue as a matter of priority. Psychology of combat. A key lesson for me from this firefight was that personal recollection alone is an unreliable guide to what happens in combat. Unless you happen to be right on the spot where a particular incident occurs, you have no way of knowing about it or even being sure that it actually happened. Conversely, if you are on the spot, the psychology of combat is such that you probably can't remember it in detail. You are like the victim of a car accident, able to remember specific moments with blinding clarity, but often unable to sequence these recollections. Moreover, such recollections are often simply wrong. Consider my failure to notice the trees, my inability to remember shooting the militia fighter until several days later, my incorrect assessment of the point at which the contact began. Only by using video evidence, the transcripts of radio logs, and the company's war diary, along with other people's recollections, can I be sure that any of this account even approaches reality, and even then, it is undoubtedly biased. It may be that I am particularly weak-minded in this regard, but other people's evidence supports this impression. For example, as the battalion patrol master, I often debriefed patrols after combat action. Almost invariably, in the first few minutes after a firefight, most members of the patrol would have different views of what had happened, down to the number of enemy, the location of the contact, who shot whom, the sequence of events, and so on. After leaving them to discuss things among themselves, in almost all cases I found that they agreed on the fundamentals of the incident. But again, almost always, it was the dominant personalities of the group, or those who were most experienced in combat, whose version of events seemed to emerge. I was never entirely confident, without some form of collateral evidence, that the patrol's version of events was accurate. Incidentally, If this is the difficulty of an immediate debrief, pity the military historian trying to piece together an incident years later. We always tend to remember things happening in a neater, more coherent fashion than was actually the case. I claim no particular accuracy for this account, except to say that it does not differ, except in minor detail, from other accounts and collateral information. We may well all be wrong. Investigations. The final lesson from Matane is that any incident in a modern conflict, particularly a low-intensity campaign like Timor, will be investigated in detail if it involves loss of life. This admittedly came as a surprise to me at the time, but in retrospect it was inevitable, and from a government point of view, entirely justified. Later incidents were also investigated in detail, and some, such as the Special Air Service ambush at Suwai on October 9th, are still under investigation. The manner in which this investigation of Matane was carried out was somewhat unnecessarily harsh, however. An intelligence approach rather than a military police approach to the problem, applying more finesse to interrogation and less harshness, might have brought better results. As it was, the morale of all the participants was severely dented for most of the rest of the tour, and many of us are still reluctant to discuss the incident.